voices. Ooh, born from the need to feel connected to voices strong and uncollected. From island shores to distant lands, we reach across with open hands. Pacifica Wire, connecting our voices, lifting every voice higher, on air and online. We're tuning in together, no matter the weather. United we inspire. Pacifica Wire, from the heart of the industry to your home and family, with new tech and legacy, we share our destiny. We laugh and we learn, we cry and we cheer. Though miles apart, we're always near. The same show, the same time, a rhythm, a style. Pacifica Wire, lifting every voice higher. Stories told side by side, on air and online. com.
The script. Planet FM 104.6 Pacifica YPW live on a Saturday afternoon. My law lover, Talofa lover, and it's great to be here with you on the Saturday. A little bit chilly. We've had a bit of rain out there, so if you're out and about, please do take care and drive safely to those conditions. And we do hope your afternoon is going well. And thanks for tuning in. We're here with you for an hour. And we look forward to having a conversation, connecting our voices, which is what we are all about. Now, as we do, I would like to introduce to you, and in our Samoan community, we have a saying about service, and this special guest epitomizes service. She is not only a fierce advocate within our Samoan Pacifica community, but she is a veteran public servant here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And her love of her community, her love of her electorate, I'm going to tell you soon who she is, but she has had a long history in the public service. She was in the local board for the Mangere o Tahuhu area. She was the chairperson, and then she moved into central government and became a list MP with the Labour Party, and then successfully in 2023 she won the Mangere electorate and is currently their MP. She's also been very instrumental in some key events in our wider Pacifica community, namely recently the repeal of the Western Samoan 1982 Citizenship Bill. Le Maunga, Lydia Sorsene, was on the select committee, and of course that historic event that took place last year that saw so many of our elderly Pacifica gain their citizenship, I should say. They got that back. So I'm not going to tell you more, because we are going to tell an all with the amazing and dedicated MP for Mangere, Le Maunga, Lydia Sorsene. Mā lō lava le au fionga, Le Maunga. It is so good to have you here with us. Very nice to see you.
Oh, Talofa lover, Gladys, and look, thanks for the opportunity to come in and just share a few reflections and a few thoughts. So, pa Talofa to ilu malu o fa longolongo mai le nitu la malo so for mama lang yam mai. Thank you.
And connecting our voices is what we're all about, and I just wanted to share, we have a little bit of a connection, that many, many moons ago, you were my boss when I worked for parliamentary services back in the day in Mangere, and that was my first sort of introduction into the world of politics. So we fast forward, and it's just amazing to see your journey and where you are today. So I thought I would share, because once upon a time, yeah, there are stories there, but we'll never tell.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, thanks for the reminder. I'd actually forgotten about that, Gladys, but I think we were more colleagues. Yeah. It wasn't a time that we'd crossed paths and we were working for the same member of parliament, and it certainly wasn't easy. For those of you who don't know what it's like to work for a member of parliament, members of parliament can be very demanding. So you have to have intuition. You've got to have a really bubbly personality, because at tough times, I think we just laughed our way through. And then we had some really nice Pacific food that
yes.
we would share often. So those were, and they were great memories. You know, we're all on a learning journey. And never did I sort of think that I would end up where I am now, and yourself too. You've come a long way, and you've done some amazing work, particularly with media, and getting our voices across and connecting, as you say.
Speaking of your journey, not only in the public service, but your service in the church with your parents, who were one of the most instrumental, you know, church should I say, parents in those early days of the 50s, 60s, 70s who built the one of the first Pacific, what was it, Congregational Samoan Churches in Otara. So right from the beginning, you have been serving. Can you share with us that journey?
Oh, look, sure. Like many Pacific migrants, my parents came out to New Zealand, and I talk about it in my maiden statement in Parliament a few years back. And I guess as the last kid, the last child, my parents served the church. They actually met in New Zealand. They didn't actually come together. So they came as single people, like many of the Pacific Wave at that time. And the research that I did, the government at the time made a conscious decision about relaxing immigration laws and specifically focused on Samoa, Tonga, may have been Fiji as well, because realm countries, Cook Island, Niue and Tokelau, already were able to gain access in and out of New Zealand. And New Zealand needed workers at that time. So there was no RSE scheme. So it was probably an RSE scheme with a different design.
Oh, okay.
And so the government at the time. So that's how my parents arrived in the very early 50s. And my dad was actually at Theological College at Mālua. Bit of a character, bit of a naughty episode. So he gets on the ship and comes out because his mother says to him from Falefa, you better go do something with your life. And sent him out here. Not long after that, my uncle, Toitū Nualitia, he came out to actually look for his brother, so I'm told. But they ended up working at Kinleith at the pulp and paper mills.
Tokoroa?
In Tokoroa. And so settled there with some of the Samoan families, because at the time they were single, and with a lot of Cook Island families. So there was a lot of Pacific families that were working at the time.
Mm.
From what I can understand, they all supported one another. New Zealand was cold. New Zealand had a different way of life, and they were used to the village way of life. Particularly it was the church that kept them together and just our customs in Pacific. So we're told that they lived in Parnell in the boarding houses, boy meets girl, and the rest is really history. And so as they were working and starting a family like many of our Pacific parents, they had then been contacted because my father had been in the church. He didn't graduate, but he did finish eventually studies. Mm-hmm. He'd worked out an arrangement with clergy here and was strongly supported by Presbytery, but also Ifakasa, those who made the rules, the governance back in the day. So he was then allowed to graduate through that system.
Mm-hmm.
So he was quite blessed, you know, to be allowed after his episode of getting up to mischief. And, yeah, I don't really know a lot of detail, but anyway. Then at the time, he began to work with clergy. So the Ifakasa Church back home in Samoa was a very strong denomination.
Yeah.
And him and my mum were given an opportunity. So Graylin Ifakasa is the first church. Then Newtown in Wellington.
Okay.
They all went down to help. And then they come back and they needed a minister, reverend, in Otara. And when before I was born, all of those things were done. And then, yeah, so when I come into the world, my parents are already at Otara Ifakasa as the first founding minister, and grew up there and church planting and helping many families to settle in South Auckland, because at the time Otara seemed to be the growing. But it was still, I think it was still classed as a new suburb. And there was quite a lot of house building and affordability. But I was quite... I do make a statement in my maiden statement where it needed things like parks and facilities for communities. So that communities, that families, you can have the same facilities like other leafy suburbs. And so Otara at the time, I think Otara Shopping Centre had just opened, maybe 1 or 2 years.
Gosh.
By the time we got there. Oh, no, beforehand. We were there beforehand, that's right. So there were a lot of migrant, Pacific migrant families who were able to purchase a home, and my parents started there. And then they were in charge of fundraising, building a church, helping our community to come to a country, a new country, and then be able to still communicate and come together and do what they usually do, because it was quite a foreign land and people's English. So my dad did a lot of advocacy work. He wasn't qualified, but he still did a lot of work around social issues, like helping people in hospital, immigration seemed to be a big one, and even in just helping people knock on doors, how to get a loan, how to purchase furniture, how to do a lot of things. So him and Mum, from what I can remember, our house was always had lots of people coming in and out. So we were expected, even as little kids, you know, make a cup of tea, do the hospitable thing. So, yeah, that's where we grew up, in Otara.
And you've, you know, you started service at that age and you haven't stopped. You've continued to serve your community and wider community. When did you know that working in public service or leading into a career where you are now as a seasoned politician, where did it all start for you?
I think if I recall correctly, when I was in my senior years, I really wanted to play sport, and I was actually quite good at it.
Nice.
But a lot of the reps, like netball and athletics at the time, were all on Sundays. And I would plead with my parents, and my mother would say to me, "Don't even bother asking, because you know what Sunday is. Sunday is church, and that's it.
That's a no."
And so it was quite frustrating as a teenager. I would get in reps every year. I wanted to play sport like a couple of my teammates, but I never gave up asking. But I always got the big no. "You know what you do on Sunday? Sunday is church." So. Public service, I had a really good tutor, she was like a senior mistress at school, and she told me, "You're very good with people, you like listening to people, you like helping them, you need to go in social service." When I looked at social welfare, I thought, that's the last thing I want to do. That's like an extension of home.
Yeah,
I'm forever
what you're already
serving.
Doing.
Yeah, so you know, I sort of bit for a book at the time, and I thought, that's the last thing I wanted to. And even my parents were saying, "You should do something useful." My mother kept saying to me, "Do something useful with your life." And I'm thinking, I am doing something useful. I did want to go to university, but then when I saw what my cousins were going through and the pressure of studies, I was quite the academic student. But when I was in sixth form, and there's UE, school C UE.
That's right, yeah.
And you know, the pressure was on to get accredited, and it was a big thing at church.
Yeah.
The results of school C, the results of UE.
Yeah.
And that pressure was pretty tough. So if you didn't get accredited, you had to sit those exams, and I was going, oh my goodness. Well, I would fall asleep, because what would happen when I was studying, I would finish school, and then we come home, and we have to do church stuff. Community stuff.
Yeah.
So I would open my books at 10 p.m. and I'd be falling asleep at 10:30 p.m. I think I tripped up in it, because I really wanted to head into economics and finance, because I wanted to find out about money, how to make more money, and then how does the economy work. But my parents were pushing, my mum was pushing me towards social service, and I'm thinking, but I do serving all day. That's the last thing I want to do. Yeah, but anyway.
And here you are. So it was a senior mistress.
Yeah, she talked to me about careers.
Okay.
And she said to me, I would do well if I put my mind to it and really focused on solutions. And she said, I said to her, but the problem that I found with Ministry of Social Welfare at that time, I said, the problem I had with that system is you're making people dependent on a system that can only go so far. Why don't you make people independent? And if it's financial independence, then why can't we do that? Because I'd seen what I'd seen back home, And, you know, we say we were, you know, there's not a lot of money in Samoa. Actually, in agriculture, because our grandmother, she was a very successful farmer. And she didn't just farm cows and
right.
and the like. She actually did the whole fishing thing. She had chickens. She was actually really quite wealthy. And in the sense of farming.
Yeah, totally.
Because that's how she funded her children to come to New Zealand and other countries. I have cousins all over the Pacific because my grandfather has sisters who went to Tonga and Fiji, and they've settled there ever since. So apparently my dad and his cousins would travel the Pacific because they could afford to, which was a 3-month journey on a ship, per se. Wow. So, you know, there's that sort of side of things.
And those are stories we don't hear about.
No, so we've got cousins that are Tongan, cousins that are Fijian, and when we have family reunions, they've attended. And it's pretty amazing. And
that is
a lot of families are like that. It's not just us. We're not, you know, unique in that sense. Many of Samoans have family members in Fiji and Tonga. So my grandfather's sisters, all his sisters married, like Auntie married Tongan men, the Browns and the Afiakis, and then the Fijian side, and there's, so all those villages. And because my grandfather's sisters never returned to Samoa, they married in Tonga, they married in Fiji and stayed there.
So you are definitely part of the Pacific wider region, the Moana Nui Akiwa.
I think many of our Pacific brothers and sisters are. So, yeah, quite. And we didn't know about it. So I guess what I'm saying is we knew we had cousins.
Yeah.
We didn't realise how big the village was until we sat down some decades ago and went, oh, so we had a big family reunion. And then we were able to go back in genealogy. And we're going, oh, right, okay, so that's where that tribe comes from. But because your parents explain, and my dad had a lot of stories to tell us, and even my mum, but you're just so busy in life, it's not till you sort of sit down and think, oh, how are we connected to those Tongans over there?
Yeah.
How are we connected to... So I think as we go back in genealogy, Pacific people have very interesting connections to tell. So anyway, sorry to go off track, but...
Not at all. Yeah. Those stories are the ones that we need. It's a reminder of where we are today and where we're going. And that's amazing hearing about your grandmother as a farming.
Yeah.
Agriculture, and what she was able to do. Because that carries on in your line, doesn't it? That work ethic, having that strong sense of business...
Yeah, Grandma was widowed quite young. I think her husband passed in her mid-40s. And she had eight or nine children. I'm just trying to remember quickly. She actually worked on her farm and fishing and taught her children. Because usually in the Samoan custom that I'm aware of is when the husband passes, the woman and children go back to her village. Our grandma stayed. She stayed, remained in Falefa, and continued to serve her husband's family and then also fed her family with all the different... And so I know that my father's older siblings... They had to work the land. They were farmers. They did very well and looked after grandma. And the four younger children all went out to New Zealand and et cetera. So, but many families did that. Many families have survived through agricultural methods by way of farming, whether it's stock, whether it's in the sea, whether it's producing all of that. And that continues with a lot of our family members back home. It's the agriculture, it's the land, and it's quite fertile in different parts of Samoa, but that's how families have survived over, centuries, decades, is you work the land and you save up, you sell the produce, and then that's how... I think it's quite different today because of remittances, but according to what our parents told us, it was the agricultural land. People worked the farms, people did what they had to do to then sell the produce, get funds, and And it's probably very similar to the strategy that farmers do here in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Probably a bit more technical and a lot more money. I met one of our friend's son who works for Fonterra, so I just need to tell this
story. Yeah.
And I said to him this week, can you help make the butter cheaper in New Zealand?
Yes.
Yeah, but anyway.
And his answer was, yeah, sure.
He looked at me and he said, Auntie, I work at Fonterra. And I said, yeah, but you guys, you know, Fonterra, it's a brand. We make butter, and how come we have to pay $15 for it? And then I said, but it's all right, son. I thought I'd just say that to you. Poor guy.
Maybe that could be, something that butter, making butter in Samoa.
They actually do make butter. Grandma, one of my aunties showed us, not grandma, it was grandma's techniques. But I think many of our matuas in Pacific Islands have grown up learning methods.
Yeah.
So without refrigeration, without the techniques we have today, they actually just learnt how to live off the land and survive.
Mm.
And so over time, they've taught their children. I mean, I guess how we grow up now in New Zealand, we've got everything at our fingertips.
Yeah.
But actually, living organically is a much better life for Pacific people. Healthier when you look at how people live back home. We're quite spoilt by the way we live now. I guess the research shows that people who actually live off the land organically actually live better lives. And it's better health issues, mental health issues. So there is probably some truth to that.
One of the things I was always marvelled at you was your thirst for knowledge. And I remember in the office, you would be pouring through screeds and screeds of research and papers, especially when we had to deal with working with immigration, welfare. And I just used to look at you thinking, you look like you're really enjoying that. You just had a thirst for it. I didn't, admittedly. And so it's no surprise that you would head into the world of local government at that stage.
I think I had a love of reading as a child. So as a child, we were quite limited as to what we were allowed to do. And certainly for us girls, we weren't far from my mother's reach in terms of the whaaus we had to do, the tasks and chores and jobs. And so our mother, our parents did, but more so my mother, because we all became Sunday school teachers and we all became youth leaders. And our mother would always expect us, because we had to recite. So she had a certain way of her children. And while she led the mothers' groups and she had youth leaders, et cetera, she expected her children to be able to research, understand what you're doing. And when you're in teaching, my mother was really strict. In fact, I think she'd get in trouble with the law for some of her ways, her Samoan
discipline. I think there'd be many of our parents.
Well, especially when you've got the journal. But I developed a real thirst for reading because of my dad's clergy work. I would have to do the reading. So not only did I have to, myself and my siblings, but I always got it because being the youngest, you do it. So I was always told, voluntold, what to do. And because I would have to understand policies and then interpret to my parents, my mother would say, what does this letter mean, which is in English? And then I'd be reading it and then she'd say, well, what does it mean? And I said, Mum, it says that you have to obey the law. She goes, why? She would always question, why do I have to obey the law in Psalm 1? So we didn't speak English at home. We had to speak Psalm 1. If our mother heard us, we would have regular meals with cousins. If we were heard speaking English, we were disciplined in the sense that. And so at the time, it was quite pressure to speak the language. But actually, as you learn the language, it just becomes natural to you. Not realising that I would utilise all these skills in my role. And so it's a huge benefit. And and sometimes it is challenging because I want to know more, particularly with the Samoan formal language.
Yeah.
Because I want to communicate. And so I find that I still have to research. It's important in the job that I have now, when you're trying to educate and help people understand the law and why Parliament writes the law and what happens with that law. It's really important to help people understand and help people, help educate people. Because I think when sometimes when ministries' policies come out, many people in Aotearoa say, well, why would you do that? Why would you write that bill?
Yeah.
Like what we're seeing in Parliament now is a real, in my view, as a Labor MP, is a real assault on people's choices. And so we've seen work in iwi, we've seen the attack on pay equity, we're seeing that just the disagreement we're having in education. And so this government is quite, they've got their manifesto and we've got ours. And so when you come across those in my work, you've got to be able to read policy, you've got to be able to read law, then you've got to be able to stitch it together and say, well, what's the purpose of that law? Why would they write that? Why would they change the law? What is behind this? So, and that's what I see in my work. So it's important for me to educate myself. And if I don't understand it, then I have to ask questions. And I'm thinking, well, why would you write a law like that? That's a dumb law. Because I'm thinking, so what about our people who don't have a lot of money, who have quite limited money, like our elderly, and then we've got our disabled, and then we've got our communities where English is their second, third language. How are they going to understand that? So when I was working in the Auckland Council, it was really important to me that our people would be able, when I say our people, our community members, that sometimes when there's changes in policy, I would always ask officials, how are you going to communicate that with our community? And then I would sort of think about some things that I've heard, like in Māngere o Tāhu, and people would ask me a question, and I'd think, and I'd say sometimes, well, I don't, actually, that's a really good question. Let me go back and ask officials. Because sometimes as members, elected members, you don't know everything. There are scenarios in our community where somebody will ask you a question, and I think, actually, I don't know. I don't know. I need to go back and find out. So that's where reading and research is a really important aspect that you've got to be able to do. And if you struggle with it, you've got to actually ask for help.
Are the representatives getting better at that, communicating that with the constituents? Did you see that along the way, that there was more emphasis on, like, you know, we need to get better at communicating the messages to our constituents, to the people?
I think sometimes when a law, one of the things that I see in Parliament and the work that I used to do in council is I would sit down and I would think about the thousands of constituents that I represent, and it's quite the breadth. So we have constituents who are quite well off, you know, quite well to do, don't really have issues with economic background, and live comfortably, and that's great because they've worked hard. Some of them have worked really hard to achieve that. And then we've got, across the spectrum, community members who can't even afford next week's groceries, or they can't afford their children's uniforms. And it's about then sitting down and then thinking, okay, what am I supposed to do to help this community? So when I see things like public services, buses, libraries, things that people are entitled to, I see that government members, it is our responsibility to really try and help our community. And if I can't help them, then try to really strongly advocate for those community members. So I would ask a lot of questions around public consultation. To the officials, how have you consulted our people? How are our people supposed to know? Where do they go? And why is it not free? How do you expect people to understand a law change They can't even get access. So there's something wrong with that picture, I would say. Then sometimes the officials in council would say to me, well, they're available. And I would say, where? They're available online. And I said, I'll tell you how many of our Pacific elders who go online. It's like under 5%, or maybe 10%. Mm. So how are our people supposed to know? Because many of our Pacific communities listen to the radio. They really like the radio because they can understand. Mm. The language is clear. The announcers speak slower. So they get it. So if you're not, if you've got a law change or a policy change and there's no radio comms, how else are people supposed to know? So they say, oh, well, it's in the newsletter. Well, the newsletters are in English. So if you don't have translation, then what happens? And so I don't think it's totally solved, but I think there's been strong measures to help our communities that English is their second or third language, just to help things like rates rebate or the libraries. And I think COVID really highlighted the challenges of communication and then the challenges of isolation, because it was a big worry for our community members that were elderly, that lived alone. Then there was, I also had a big worry about our community members who had limited budgets. Mm. So, you know, what was happening, what was available, how could you communicate in health-wise?
Advocacy, obviously a huge part of the work you do and who you are. On a personal level, health advocacy, you've played a really instrumental role in that. And I'm wondering if you are able to share with us just a journey with your own health.
Sure. I think the first thing with me was you can help everyone. You can go out and you have this big goal to help many, many people, which is great. But then you've got to remember yourself. You're only as good as your health is good. And so when I was diagnosed last year with breast cancer, first thing was I was in denial. I was probably in shock thinking, what? Actually, it's quite the journey, and it's coming up to next month to a year when I had surgery.
Gosh.
My biggest message to anyone in the public domain is look after yourself. It's great to look after everybody else, but you actually have to put yourself first. I'm only able to do this job because of that and because of the support around me. So my family have been incredibly supportive. My work have been everyone's been just so tremendous. And our health service, I just can't fault them. I have to say this, though. Let me be honest. I've been through a number of specialists. I questioned everything. I read everything.
Yeah.
And it was quite challenging in the sense that when you've got somebody sitting across from you, and they were really blunt, the first two specialists, I'll be honest, I just really wanted to get up and smack them and say, sorry, because of the way the message was delivered.
Yeah.
I thought it could be delivered better. And our health professionals in New Zealand work very, very hard. So I really want to say thank you at every level, whether they're a specialist doctor, all the way down to the nurses on the wards, our orderlies, our health staff. They are patient, people are kind. They're just amazing individuals. And so when the message was delivered to me, I had specialists sitting across from me, and I knew something was up because we'd just gone overseas and come back just for a quick break to see our eldest moko. And I'd missed a call. But then I think I had gone back to work and I got a call, and because I had only spoken to them recently. So when I missed a call, I looked at my phone. I was in Wellington. I looked at my phone and I thought, and immediately I knew something was up. Just something inside of me said, something's up. Mm. And then I thought, okay, you can worry and go a bit of a have a sort of become like a space cadet or find out what's happening. So then I think I rang. No, I didn't ring. I didn't tell anybody.
No.
But I just came home and said to my husband, I need to go to see the specialist. He looked at me. I looked at him, but I didn't say anything. I wanted confirmation and I wanted to see the evidence. And I wanted to know that they were talking to the right person with the right diagnosis.
Yeah.
So it was important to me. You are talking about me. That's all my personal details. Mm. That is my result.
Yeah.
Because it better not be anybody else's. And so I really wanted to know 110% that was exactly. The specialist had a job to do. And I'm just I'm a number. So when they told me, I looked at my husband. My husband looked at me. I had no emotion because I just felt that this was a very interesting, different experience. I had never come across this because I thought my health was pretty good and I thought I was doing an okay job in the work that I've done up till that time.
Yeah.
So I don't think I handled it good. I think I probably was in shock. We had a family event that same week, and according to my family, it wasn't me. They knew something was up. And I didn't really say anything. I'd gone to the family event. I really like food, but apparently I didn't really eat much. And I looked so, yeah, but nobody wanted to be brave and ask me because I probably would have punched the lights out. So that's not a very good response. So I do apologise to the listeners. I was in shock.
It's human.
Yeah, and so I wanted to see the evidence and I wanted to know everything. And I wanted to know, okay, so what's next? So they give you options. They'll give you the information. And I said, I want to see the evidence. I want to know exactly. I don't think I said, how did we get here? I think I just said, I want to see everything. I want to know it's me. Those are my stats. Those are my tests. I just wanted to be 110% sure that they had everything right. And they did. You know, they were doing their job. And health professionals are under a lot of pressure.
Mm.
And so I really wanted to acknowledge the health professionals at their professionalism. But I wasn't ready to listen to them. So I think I get up to specialist number 5. And I found it brutal. But then I said to hubby, we decided that I wasn't going to tell the kids. I just needed to know all of the information first.
Mm.
And then I can go and have my cry and then talk to my children and talk to our children. And it was interesting. It's been a journey. But I wanted it black and white because in the area that I work now, everything is pretty much black and white. So that was the same methodology that I was working with. I wanted to see the evidence, make sure it was me. And yes, it was me. And then I didn't want to go overboard with, oh my gosh, this has happened. And because it's just so common. So I think the strongest message that I can advocate is you've got to look after yourself. You get to a certain point in your life where actually you need a bit more help. No, you're not a superhero. And you can do some really good work, but you've actually got to accept people's help and people's wisdom. And so I went through that journey. I think everyone's been pretty tremendous. But I think also because I'm a strong advocate, per se, I questioned everything. I think I was a real pain patient because I wanted to know. I just wanted to know things like longevity, diagnosis, what does that mean? So health plays a big part in that you've got to, when you're under a pressurized job as a public servant, especially in this work, you have to keep an eye on your health. So I love life. I love food, I love people, and that's great, but you've still got to look after it because our job in Wellington is to work hard for all New Zealanders, but you've got to put your health at the same level, And so you can only operate 110% as if your health, whether it's your mental health, whether it's your health and well-being, you've got to keep a very close eye on that. That would be my strongest message. And don't miss your specialist appointments.
Don't miss those specialist appointments. And we're loving talking to you. And we're coming back straight after the break with our very special guest, Le Maunga Lydia Sosene, right here on Planet FM 104.6. Pacifica Wire, connecting our voices. We'll be right back. Here's Black Rose, music from Fiji. Medabutu. Pacifica Wire, out Planet FM, I should say, 104.6 with the Fiji sensation Black Rose, Medabutu. And welcome back to PW Live. Our very special guest live in the studio with us here is the MP for Mangere, Labour Party MP, Le Maunga Lydia Sosene, who has talked to us about her staunch advocacy, not only for her community, but for herself and for her family, and just such a strong message that you have talked about, Tullinord, with us. And it's been hard, I must say, it has been a hard time for you and your colleagues down in Wellington with the loss of two of your colleagues, very dear to your heart, both of them, but also our Pacifica brother, the late Whanana Efeso Collins. So how do you carry on? Like, you're in the chamber, you're debating each other, you're up against each other as political allies, you know, opponents, and then something like that happens. How do you weather that?
If I think back to when we lost FSL, huge loss to the community. He was with us the night before. So there was a meeting, and himself and Jenny Salisa were the new chairs of one of the committees. Mm. We come out of the room. I think our meeting finished around about 8 p.m. or 7:30 p.m. or something like that. We sort of just come out of the room. We're quite pleased of the result. It was one of the committees that works with Pacific communities, and I think it's nationwide, but also in the Pacific region. And then Jenny turns around and says, oh, we didn't get a photo with your vessel, or we didn't get a photo. We said, oh, yeah, you guys are the new chairs. And we usually, as you know, politicians, we like photos. And, you know, it's the humour. It helps you get through different stages. And then the next day it all happened. And it was just, we were in shock. But you have to carry on. You've got to be able to provide some strength for the community. Huge loss with our vessel, and especially Fia and the girls. We only played a very small part in helping our other colleagues as well. We are the only Pacific caucus in Parliament with our colleague Tiano for the Greens. And so it was just... It was pretty shockful time. The whole of Parliament stopped. We did go in. The Speaker allowed us all to come together to grieve. But actually, once that was over, we then had to help people in our community, and particularly the loss of FESL. And being so personal, but also being a public figure. So we all had our little time, and then we just came together and needed to continue. And many of us had worked with FSO in the community, just like so many others. But also you think of Fia and the girls, and it was just, you know, you want them to have personal time, which Fia is going through now in terms of grief. And the loss is huge because you're working right next to him. He'd only had his maiden statement the week before. Mm. And so it was a huge ordeal for his family, and then the shock of losing him so sudden. So it then puts your health back into it. It brings in that, I just feel that all people in public roles, you've really got to equip yourself and talk to the people around you, because the job is demanding, and it is so demanding, and so you've got to be up for that race, and you've got to be able to function at the best possible, because you're an advocate for your community, you're an advocate for your electorate, you're an advocate for your caucus, and it's a really big jobs. And so you've got to think about yourself, you've got to be able to make that self-assessment, you've got to be aware of what's happening, and talk to your leaders. Because in my journey, the leaders were, Chris was fantastic, and Carmel, and my Pacific caucus, and all my colleagues, because you know, I'm still able to have rest breaks and different requests. And so it's my colleagues around me who, when I'm sort of stepping away for an hour or a couple of hours or whatever it is, they fill the spaces, because it's really important. We have standing orders in Parliament. There are rules around caucuses being their members of Parliament turning up for duty. And so it's my caucus colleagues that step in when I'm away for an appointment or whatever. And then the loss of Takutai. We were all with Takutai at Matariki up in Ngāti Whātua. And I knew things had not been going well for her. I was talking to her on the morning, so... We all thought we had to be there very early. So Takutai, Aupito, myself and others, we were like there at 4:30 a.m. And it was just that week. So the following week, Takutai passed. It's a huge loss. When you lose a colleague, that is, you've got the mawhana, because they're either Māori or they're Pacific, and you work together in the community. Because people have lives before you've arrived at Parliament.
Yep.
And you know leaders in the community. You've either worked with them because the kaupapa is similar. You're helping people in your community with different issues. FSL came from local government. I came from local government. I think I was just before him. He was in Ōtara Papatoetoe, I was in Māngere Ōtāhuhu. We had our challenges. And it's because you're a strong advocate, you don't always agree with the methodology, but you want the same result for your people.
Yep.
You want good wages, you want good facilities. And so you do work hard. You might be coming from a different angle, but you want the same result. You want to help your community, you want to help young people, old people. But when you lose a colleague from different political parties, your response is humane. We, as members of parliament, we work from different caucuses. You don't always agree. That's why you're in there, because you believe your caucus has got all the answers to many of the problems. And so you believe in that kaupapa. So you go in wanting to work hard. It's an amazing opportunity. I would encourage every parliamentarian, you never forget where you came from. Never forget where you came from. So you're in there working hard for your people from your community. That is a huge, it's a huge role, and it's a huge blessing. And you're in there for a period of time, however long that may be, whether it's decades or years. But it's a great place to work. It's also... As a parliamentarian, you have to work hard. So there's never, you have rest periods, but the kaupapa is
doesn't stop.
Ongoing. You come back to your community. You must go to see your community events, schools, etc., and the different groups and churches, because people want to know. People have got issues. People have got problems. They need to come to you, to talk to you, to reach you, to so you can help them. So that's, you know that in the public service. That's why you enter the public service. You want to help the public service, and serve the public. So those are all things I sort of learnt. And so I don't know that I've stopped since I was a kid and helping people, making people cups of teas. But I just think it's a huge blessing. And one thing that I've learned from my health journey is, yeah, okay, this has happened to me, and I've had to make a few changes in that. But people get sick. People become unwell. And I have learned a lot about this whole topic, about breast cancer. And so I've wanted to help. One of my strongest messages, don't miss your appointment. And if you can do anything to make a few lifestyle changes, you know, go for it. Do the walk. Eat less. I try to eat less. I like food. It's hard because island food is so good.
So good.
Yeah. And so just little things like that. Parliament is difficult in the sense that you have to manage. You've got to be able to manage. And if you don't, then you ask for help. And you ask your caucus leaders, because there is a lot of support. There is a lot of help. But you've got to make the first step. And don't just kid yourself by thinking, oh, yeah, I can function. Well, no. If you need help, ask for it. And there is help there for you.
I wish we could continue our Talanoa, but all great things must come to an end. We have been speaking with a Member of Parliament, the MP for Māngere Labour Party, Le Maunga Lidia Sosene. A blessing indeed. We wish you all the best. We know you're out and about out there, and that you're heading out there somewhere right now. So, whakataetele lava, and connecting our voices with you.
Thank you, Gladys. Thank you for the opportunity, and I hope I've been able to just share a few reflections, and all the best with your work as we go forward. Take care, lover. No matter.